60 seconds.
We choose to go to the moon.
40 feet down, 2.5.
Neil said, we can't land here.
Everyone is sitting there not knowing what has happened.
30 seconds.
We might not make it.
13 minutes to the moon. From the BBC World Service. Coming soon.
This is The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Kate Lamble. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. In 1798, in a small leafy village in Surrey, England, a Christian minister called Thomas Malthus sat thinking. He'd been mulling over his work, the baptisms and the funerals he'd been carrying out over the last few years, and he'd come to a realisation. There were many more children being born than people dying. The population of the country, he decided, had to be increasing. Then the minister started to wonder about all the crops that would need to be grown to feed all these extra mouths, and he imagined a time when the earth could no longer support the number of people living on it. Malthus's prediction became famous, but it never came true. Over 200 years later, in April this year, an American professor, Chris Barrett, gave a speech at the United Nations in Rome. He warned that resources like land and water are becoming more limited, and he called food security, our ability to give everyone on the planet nutritious meals, the defining global challenge of the century.
The prospect of failing to meet the food security challenge is nothing short of an existential crisis for states around the world and for stable societies.
And it got us thinking. Already 7.7 billion people live on Earth. Billions more are predicted to join that number by the end of the century. Will it be possible to feed everyone? So this week, on The Inquiry, we're asking, how can we feed 11 billion people?
Part 1. The Green Revolution.
I got my rucksack together and I came to Colombia for a 3-month internship.
Our first expert witness, Andy Jarvis, had just left university when he took a flight from England into the middle of a country gripped by armed conflict.
You have this incredible paradox. I mean, the beauty of the place, the environment is just incredible. But then the first week I arrived, I heard 2 bombs go off and I heard a shootout in the street.
Andy is still in Colombia 18 years later. He lives in Cali, where he works on farming policies at the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture.
I've learned to love this country just as much as my home.
SEAT, where Andy works, was set up in the 1960s, another time when people started to worry that food production couldn't keep up with population increases.
Well, what we had in the 60s was an agricultural production that was pretty basic, really. Many parts of the world were very low in terms of their productivity levels. Pests and diseases were a major concern. And so there were a number of books that came out that were kind of predicting this point where the planet was going to exceed its carrying capacity in terms of delivering food to so many people.
Back then, scientists, charities and governments joined together so they could coordinate a response. And they decided they should focus on one thing, increasing crop yields.
So if we're going to have 1 hectare in agriculture, let's make sure that with that 1 hectare, we're maximising the amount of food that we produce.
Starting with cereals like rice and wheat, projects were set up to see if scientists could breed new plants which produced more grain, allowing you to get more food from a single field.
So you have crop breeders planting hundreds and hundreds of different varieties out there, seeing which ones are doing best.
Then they'd cross-pollinate strains, matching the best plants with the best plants to see if they could grow a new generation, bigger and better than those that came before it. The work became known as the Green Revolution.
In many cases, it's not just like looking for the biggest grain. For example, one of the big solutions that the Green Revolution gave were plants that wouldn't fall over. What you needed is a rice plant with the architecture to be able to actually hold all of that grain up. In the space of about 10 years, they doubled yields. And there are studies showing that it's saved millions and millions of lives, essentially, from hunger, from nutritional deficits.
One of the researchers, Norman Borlaug, was even awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for his efforts.
So it was a huge solution. It was a global effort that produced global level impacts.
The Green Revolution moved agricultural practices forward at a rate that had never been seen before and hasn't been seen since.
Population is catching up with us. We don't have the capacity to produce enough food on the amount of land we have available right now for that 11 billion people that is being predicted.
We're running out of the small but significant changes which the scientists of the 1960s were able to exploit. And the future population growth we're facing is much larger.
And then you have other problems creeping in, the issues of climate change, for example, where that's making it harder and harder to produce that amount of yield on these agricultural fields.
Andy's not predicting an apocalyptic future of widespread starvation, but he points out that we rely on a fragile web of connections to take our food from field to table. It wouldn't take much to break a thread.
If you have one major heat wave in central Russia, for example, you're going to see spikes in the price of wheat and barley. And so then that means bread is more expensive.
And we've already seen some examples of what happens when food prices rise.
In 2008, it was a little bit of a perfect storm. It was multiple issues in different parts of the globe. And so those combined created a lower supply of certain major cereals. And then a lot of speculation kicked in.
Commodities markets panicked and the cost of food went up.
It threw a lot of people into poverty, especially in urban areas. It created violence, it created unrest in many countries. And that, I think, was a wake-up call for the world to see that food isn't just automatically delivered to the supermarket at affordable prices.
In the past, global cooperation has allowed us to greatly increase our food production. But today, we're under greater pressure than ever to grow more food. And Andy thinks, this time, there's no easy solution.
Everyone is looking for this silver bullet, and my take on it is that there is no silver bullet anymore.
Part 2, The Leaky Bucket.
Our next expert witness, Jane Ambuko, was born in Western Kenya.
I come from a smallholder family. You know, my mom is a maize farmer.
Growing up on the farm, the whole family got involved in the work.
We used to plant our own maize, you know, do the weeding, harvesting, you know. Yeah, basically I was a village girl.
And Jane noticed that like many farmers in Kenya, her family had a problem. After the harvest, they had nowhere to safely store their crops, so they'd sell all their produce immediately. Then later, when it's no longer harvest time,
they'll be buying the same maize from this trader at double the price. And that is a vicious cycle of poverty for most of the rural farmers in Kenya.
As well as the financial implications, anything farmers can't sell also risks being spoiled by pests or simply rotting. So the food that was grown won't make it to anyone's table. Today, Jane is a horticultural scientist at the University of Nairobi, and she specialises in why food is lost or wasted before it can be eaten.
The losses are estimated to be 30%. Across the world. If you look at the various parts of the world, like in Europe or let's say America, most of it is happening at the consumption. Because for developed countries, the consumers can afford to waste. They have the luxury to waste food.
But in places like Africa, just under a third of the food produced doesn't even make it to market. Imagine you're a mango farmer in Kenya. Mangoes grow in a season between November and March.
So during this period, you know, there's mango everywhere.
With so much supply, farmers either have to accept a low price for their produce or they can't sell it.
So you'll find many farmers, they have their mangoes right under the tree waiting for a buyer. So if the buyer doesn't come, it just rots under the tree. So when you go to the market, you'll also find heaps of unsellable mangoes. You know, if you find during mango season, really, the markets, you basically walk on mangoes. When you go to talk to the farmers themselves, they'll tell you they lose upwards of 80% of the crop.
Seeing 80% of your efforts simply rot away must be hugely frustrating. To keep their mangoes fresh until prices rise again, farmers would need access to cold storage. But even if they could afford to build it, many smallholders live in such remote areas of the country that there's no electricity that could keep it running.
So one of the things we've been trying to do as part of our outreach program is to introduce alternative technologies like charcoal cooling.
That's where you build a room lined with wet charcoal. As the water evaporates, it takes energy out of the air, cooling the space. But even so, farmers still have to pay to build the structure in the first place.
So what we're trying to do is to get these farmers in groups so that they can pool their resources, build it together. And when they have this, they're able to bring their produce together and negotiate for better prices from the buyers.
As part of her work, Jane has helped set up a prototype for this type of communal resource, a centre where lots of small mango farmers can come together and store their produce. But that's not all.
We have helped them to build other equipment for processing, for making juice, and also for drying the mangoes into chips.
The idea is that when farmers bring their mangoes in, all the fruit can either be stored or processed into a different product, so nothing goes to waste.
If the model works, then it should be a zero loss center.
Jane doesn't think that it's possible to completely eradicate food loss globally. But the UN has set targets for countries to halve their waste by 2030. If achieved, this could vastly increase the amount of food which reaches consumers.
We know we have to feed this increasing population. So most of what is going on currently is, you know, we think we can produce more food. Yes, production is part of the equation, but production alone can't be it. Because if we're producing and then 30% is going to waste, then it's like putting water in a bucket that has a hole, you know? So it's never going to get full. For me, addressing the challenge of food loss and waste is like sealing that hole in the bucket.
And Jane thinks sealing that hole would create a knock-on effect. Securing more sales could encourage farmers to produce more in the first place. And it's production that our next expert witness focuses on.
Part 3. Improving Nature.
Amanda Kavanagh is a researcher at the University of Illinois in the United States. She and her team study the amazing way plants get the energy they need from just sunlight and carbon dioxide, a process called photosynthesis.
At our core, we are a bunch of photosynthesis nerds. I think it is one of the most beautiful reactions on the planet. If you look out your window, you can probably see a leaf, and that leaf is absorbing the sunlight energy that's just hitting the earth, and it's taking in carbon dioxide like I'm breathing out right now. It's pretty amazing stuff.
Plants have been perfecting photosynthesis for millions of years. But it's Amanda's job to try and genetically engineer seedlings so they get better at carrying out the reaction.
It's pretty amazing to look at it and saying, and they're not doing it well enough.
And they're not. They could do it a little better.
Because the process is actually surprisingly inefficient.
Only about 5% of the sunlight energy is converted into the leaves and the biomass that make a plant grow.
And there's one key reason for that.
The infamous enzyme, Rubisco.
Inside chloroplasts, the photosynthesis factories found in every leaf of every plant on the planet, the enzyme Rubisco has a very important job. It grabs carbon dioxide so it can be converted into energy.
You know, we owe our existence to Rubisco, so all of the carbon in our bodies, at one point or another, likely pass through some version of this enzyme. It has a magnificent role in shaping our world. But with a task that big, you're sure to make a mistake. 20% of the time, the cellular machinery will grab an oxygen instead of a carbon dioxide. And that causes a downstream effect of multiple reactions to try to deal with this unwanted product.
I like to imagine Rubisco as a little bit like a pastry chef. Its job is to select the ingredients off the shelf and put them together to make a cake. But it has to work so fast that every so often it makes a mistake. And instead of grabbing sugar like it's meant to, it grabs some salt and puts that in the cake instead. Now, the two ingredients might look similar, but anyone can tell you that salty cakes are disgusting, and so these have to be thrown away. The problem is, waste disposal is really labour-intensive.
Our modelling has suggested that that could cost about 30 to 50% of a daily energy budget of a plant. And that's energy that could go into filling the grain, that could go into growing more biomass to ultimately harvest at the end of the season.
But Amanda thinks she's come up with a solution. Her team have worked to genetically engineer plants to break down the waste product more easily. And, just to be extra helpful, do it in a way that feeds more carbon dioxide back to where Rubisco works, essentially putting extra sugar around the kitchen to make the initial process more efficient as well.
And so that's what we did in our most recent advance that found a 40% biomass increase at the end of the field season.
So the plants you've grown with this change to photosynthesis have grown 40% bigger?
Yes, they have.
Next, they're planning on testing their work in crops like cowpea, also known as black-eyed pea, which is grown widely in sub-Saharan Africa. So, while the Green Revolution made some great leaps forward, there are still some crop improvements we can engineer. And Amanda thinks new ideas will emerge in the future.
Every technological innovation, every scientific discovery opens up this new toolkit that we can use, and it gives me so much optimism for the speed and the pace at which we can start to develop some solutions.
Part 4, Marginal Gains.
I am Deval Deb. I was trained as an ecologist, and then 25 years ago, I left academia and I became a farmer and a conservator.
Our final expert witness lives on a farm in eastern India.
That I call Vasudha, literally in Sanskrit, it means the Earth Mother or Gaia.
As an ecologist, Deval recognises that the work during the Green Revolution had an important impact. But he thinks that choosing to focus on just one or two high-yielding crop varieties has had some unfortunate consequences.
Seeds used to be a common resource for everyone, all over the world. But then after the 1960s, seeds were commercialized and some corporations became the arbiters of seed development and sale.
Today, around 60% of commercial seeds around the world are controlled by just three companies. And Deval thinks this market domination can cause problems.
So, for example, India used to have 110,000 varieties of rice, and these were all open exchange. Farmer to farmer, that's how thousands of varieties spread over the country.
But since farmers have been choosing to buy seeds from only a handful of companies,
now the agricultural institutions estimate that no more than 7,000 varieties are left today of rice.
So that's a huge number gone.
Yes, all of these are totally extinct from the farmers' fields.
And Deval is worried for a very specific reason. This reduction in the number of varieties of rice means genetic diversity is being lost. He started to wonder if the rice varieties that have disappeared from India could have contained some useful traits. And he started talking to farmers.
I accidentally encountered descriptions of certain varieties in a remote village. I was told, for example, this particular rice variety was fed to the women of the household during or after pregnancy.
Wondering why, Deval collected some seeds and grew them on his farm.
Then we later discovered that it contains very high amount of iron in the rice.
An element that's very important for pregnant women.
And then those farmers suggested us to collect another variety from another area where they have their relatives or friends.
So Deval travelled on to the next farm, and the next one, collecting seeds as he went.
So far, we have a collection of 1,460 varieties of rice. We are growing every year on our own farm.
All of these plants have different properties, which can help them grow in difficult environments, such as when there's too much rain or too little.
There are many varieties which are drought tolerant, some are flood tolerant, some are resistant to distinct species of pests or diseases.
And Daybell shares all of these seeds with farmers for free. But how does all this help us feed our increasing population?
There are many areas, what agriculturists call marginal agricultural farms. Marginal means, you know, there could be drought prone areas, flood prone areas, and the coastal areas which are regularly inundated by seawater incursion. In India, for example, it's about 24% of the entire arable land. So despite all this, you know, brouhaha about agricultural development and transgenics, we have not yet been able to develop one single high-yielding variety which can grow. Forget about grow. I mean, they can even survive in a salt-inundated area or a land which is regularly, you know, seasonally flooded by 10 feet deep water or 6 feet deep water or drought-prone areas. But we have hundreds of varieties which can withstand all these kind of climatic regimes.
These traditional seeds could allow us to successfully farm these marginal areas. And there's something else they can help with. Relying on just one or two crop varieties can make farmers very vulnerable to disease.
The best example about the consequence of this kind of erosion of genetic diversity is the famous Irish potato famine of the 1840s, when there was just one single variety of potato that was being grown all over the country.
In 1845, a blight arrived in Ireland, which the main potato variety had no resistance to. That year, about half the crop was destroyed, and it continued to fail until 1849. If a wider variety of potatoes had been grown, there's a chance some strains might have contained genes to resist the blight. Daybell argues that crop diversity is the best defence against future threats to our food supply.
Traditional varieties are the best bet and the only bet. And they are the only ones which can feed all these people, just as they have failed all over the world for the last 10,000 years.
So how can we feed 11 billion people? It seems questionable that we should bet on only one solution. We should use all the tools we have at our disposal to reduce waste, increase crop yields, and react to our changing environment. The market will always try to fulfil a population's demand for food. But to truly take on this challenge and keep costs low, governments, scientists and charities will have to come together to start a new green revolution. And not all of our expert witnesses are yet convinced there's enough political will to make that happen.
This inquiry was presented by Kate Lamble and produced by Tim Mansell. The researcher was Bethan Head. It was mixed by Neil Churchill and edited by Richard Varden. Our production coordinator was Iona Hammond. And if you enjoyed this episode, you might enjoy Can We Eat Our Way Out of Climate Change? You can find that wherever you download the Inquiry podcast.